Good morning. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm hosting a new KZYX series talking about California. I'm director of the Mendocino Institute, a not-for-profit research and education center. In this series, we're going to talk to Californians about California, and I hope to continue and expand on last year's series, Community and Ecology. By the way, you can listen to these discussions on the Mendocino Institute website, www.mendocinoinstitute.org. Today, our guest is Professor Julie Guthman. Professor Guthman is an associate professor of community studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's an authority on issues of alternative food movements, the political economy of food and agriculture, the politics of obesity, and many other subjects. She's an activist as well as a much sought-after university lecturer, and I can assure you that if you're interested in any of these issues, you can do no better than to read Julie Guthman. She's the author of two acclaimed books, Agrarian Dreams, The Paradox of Organic Farming in California, University of California Press, and her newest book, Weighing In, Obesity, Food Justice, and the Limits of Capitalism, also UC Press. So let's get started. Again, good morning, listeners. Good morning, Julie. Welcome to KZYX.
Thank you so much for having me on the program, Cal.
Well, I thought I'd start by just asking you a bit about your work, Julie. You're a professor, and is it okay if I call you Julie?
Sure, absolutely.
You're a professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, in the Department of Community Studies, which I know a little about. It's got a long and really fairly glorious history, if I am correct in understanding it. And I understand that there's an issue there about its continuance. But what about your work and what about the importance of that project?
Yes, the Community Studies program has had a glorious history, I'll get to the punchline that it's being disestablished. But I do want to talk about it because it figures so large in my writing these days. So the Community Studies major began about 41 or 42 years ago, when students who came to Santa Cruz were typically radical and wanted to work off campus. They wanted to work in social change organizations as part of their education. And so the original founders of the program, Mike Rutkin and Bill Freeland, took this very seriously. They thought, well, but we need to have them do this in a way that they integrate scholarship, they integrate academics. And so the major was founded around this idea of theory and practice, that students would do 6 months full-time field studies in the community, in social change organizations. And the academic work they would do would prepare them intellectually for that, and then they would come back and analyze the material. Now, the kind of way we do that has changed over the years, but that's still fundamentally what community studies has been about, participating in activist organizations or social change organizations. These days, even, we take activism to be pretty broad, just something out in the community, and then students analyze it. So what's interesting about community studies is when you can track what students have been interested in over its 41-year history to really get a sense of where social movement activity lies. Now, the first students that came to community studies and worked with Bill Freeland, who's a famous scholar of political economy of food, they were very interested in working with the UFW, and they would go out in the field. They would go to Watsonville with Bill, and that would be part of their field studies. And then for a long time, I don't think students worked so much in food and agriculture. And then beginning in the early 10, 15 years ago, there was so much interest in food and agriculture again. So many students wanted to work on food issues with the burgeoning of the organic movement. So they created my line sometime in the early 2000s, and I was hired in 2003 to be the faculty member who works with students who are interested in agriculture and food issues. And even in my 9 years there, I've kind of seen this kind of trajectory of how food movements have changed. So I see my students as kind of beacons of of what's going on in food movements. What animates them is very much what's, you know, what people are talking about outside. So when I started working there, they were very interested in organics, and then they became more interested in fair trade, and then community food security was big for a while, and localism was big for a while, and now, of course, they're all interested in food justice and food sovereignty. So that means a bunch of things to me. I mean, one thing, they're indicators of what's going on, but it also shows how alternative food itself is shifting, and it often shifts in relationship to critiques that have been generated. And so it's exciting to watch that. And I learn a lot from my students in terms of what they go and see in the field and what they bring back to me, and that's very much inspired a lot of my writing, including my latest book.
And you were going to say about the future of the studies program.
Correct. Right. And so, alas, the administration has decided to disestablish the department. It's a very, very sad and disappointing thing. It's something that some of us in the department contested heartily and heavily. And it's kind of a funny thing because it appears that it was political. But the budget cuts gave cover for it. And yet the other kind of justification for disestablishing it is that we've been replicated by the many, many internship programs that have developed around the campus that are exciting, but I think they have far less of a kind of, I don't want to say rigorous, but I think that, you know, we've been working on, not before I came, I mean, the proverbial we has been working on this major for 41 years and have really come up with kind of the gold standards of this kind of learning, where the students do a lot of intellectual preparation, both in terms of their topic, but also the methods and the ethics of working in the field, and then they analyze the material when they get back, and most internship programs don't do that at all. So, unfortunately, our efforts to address all the concerns that were ever raised by the administration fell on deaf ears, and they are disestablishing the department. It's a very sad thing.
Very sad, and something that's happening right throughout the system, I'm afraid.
Absolutely.
I know that this week there will be protests going on across the country about cutbacks in education, and very tragically, you're a case in point. And, you know, for us up here in Mendocino County, you probably know that we send lots of students down to Santa Cruz to continue their studies.
Absolutely. I've had many students from the North Coast in my classes.
So, Julie, I wonder if we could start off sort of with the big picture and ask you to say a few words about agriculture in California, really, because, this is the land of milk and honey. It's the garden in Steinbeck's East of Eden. It's the end of Tom Joad's dreams. I remember as a child entering California from the Oregon border, the anticipation of the search at the state line, for example. No Washington State apples allowed, and I remember the first fresh squeezed orange juice stand inside the state where we got giant full glasses of fresh squeezed orange juice, just unimaginable back home. What do you think about California agriculture? How do we begin to frame a discussion?
California agriculture has been exceptional. It's losing its exceptionalism, I think that. But I mean, what's amazing about California is it has been tremendously productive, and unlike most places in the United States, it's for a long time focused on crops that are specialty crops, are fruits and vegetables and nuts. California did begin, like many other states, growing grains, but beginning in the 1880s, farmers started growing specialty crops and led to not only to the abundance, but the diversity of food that is grown in California. But it's always been a very technological endeavor, and it's always depended on the exploitation of marginalized labor, different groups coming in who are politically marginalized to provide a low-wage workforce. So it's always been full of contradictions. One of the things that's really fascinated me about California agriculture is the relationship between what we grow and land values, because real estate has been such an important piece of California agriculture, part of California's development as well. It's always about the land, about, you know, people. I think Dick Walker's written about how people came to invest in land before they invested in industry. And so that kind of productivity that California has seen, and the specialty crops, which are very high-value crops, all of that has been imputed into land values. And so, you know, California agricultural land values are far above what they are in other states. And so that affects what is grown and what can be grown. And so it's this always dynamic world of possibility in California. The technologies that create abundance, create diversity, also make it very costly for new farmers to get involved, and of course lead to, you know, some of these technologies lead to all sorts of ecological and public health problems. We continue, despite the growth in organic, for example, we continue to have a very heavy pesticide regime in California.
And looking at some of your work, I've noticed you use a term, the agrarian myth, quite often. What, in terms of what you're describing now, what's real and what's myth, would you say, would you emphasize?
Yeah, I use the agrarian imaginary. Well, I think, you know, when I started doing my research on organics about, how long ago is it now, about 17 years ago, I noticed how many organic farmers invoked the idea that they were family farmers. And, you know, California never had a family farming tradition, and that the reason for that goes back to its history, its Anglo history. I mean, the people here before the Anglos came for the gold rush were the Californios that ran cattle on huge ranches. But the Anglos came for the gold rush, and they made a lot of money quickly, and that was in invested in land. California was exempt from the Homestead Act, so some of the wealthiest entrepreneurs from the gold rush were able to buy up huge tracts of land of millions of acres. And eventually those land holdings were broken up, but they were, you know, we weren't settled by this group of family farmers. There was no kind of westward movement of pioneers. So when they were broken up, they were broken up because the wheat farms weren't doing so well because there was an international wheat glut, but also because the specialty cropping was so much more lucrative. But specialty cropping required labor. Today you can grow wheat on a family farm if you have very expensive machinery. You know, these combines go for about $250,000. But you can't grow oranges or strawberries or lettuce without people who are cultivating and coming and harvesting this. So our specialty crops have always been dependent on wage labor. So there is no family farm. There never really has been a family farm tradition in California. Now, families may own the farm, but that doesn't mean that they labor on the farm. And so the whole agrarian imaginary about we need to go back to the family farm has never really applied to California.
And I think you've also said there are race issues, ethnic issues that need to be addressed if we're going to go from myth to reality.
Well, absolutely. The entire agrarian imaginary is based on this idea of, of family farmers. And when that's invoked, it's often hidden, or we don't discuss who got access to that land in the first place. So when the federal government was giving away or selling land cheaply to white farmers, white people, so they could develop farms, this was, you know, concurrent with the gathering up Native Americans and putting them on reservations. Californios were sent back to what became Mexico. African Americans in the Reconstruction era never really gained access to land. They might have been sharecroppers, but there were very few African Americans that ever owned land. And so our whole agrarian imaginary is based on, you know, a pretty race-based system of access to land.
And does that continue?
Sure, it does. I don't have the statistics with me, but I think that of ownership of land, it's clearly in the hands of whites. I mean, there are Latino and Southeast Asian farmers that lease land, but they don't hold the wealth in land. And of course, there's whites that lease land as well. And a lot of the wealth they hold, I mean, they also pay out a lot of money to the banks in the form of mortgage debt. But it's just not at all an even playing field in terms of access to land and rights to land.
Julie, just before we switch subjects a bit, I'd also like you, if you don't mind, to just mention how you put this subject into a discussion of globalization and neoliberalism, something I think you've also done.
There's many ways to think about that. I mean, the way I think about neoliberalism, by neoliberalism, you know, this we're talking about this philosophy that's never really been accomplished of leaving decisions to the market, like the market is the best alligator of goods and services. And so the goal of neoliberal projects have been trying to remove subsidies, to remove assistance, to remove regulations so business can profit, and that's somehow supposed to trickle down to the rest of us. The way that plays into my work is very much in terms of, ironically, what activists are doing to contest the food system, because I think many of the approaches to food system change rely on market, are, you know, market-based. The idea that we should, you know, if we want a better food system, we should be willing to pay more. And so, for instance, with organics, I mean, the whole system depends on, I mean, the way it works is that farmers who want to grow organically get certified. They have to comply with a bunch of regulations. They have to do all sorts of reporting. But in return, they expect a price premium that incentivizes them to grow organically. And then consumers who want that food have to then pay the difference. And so that's it's a market-oriented approach. What we're not doing is reducing or banning the practices and inputs that are so destructive. And that, to me, that falls into a kind of neoliberal framework because, you know, we're told that regulation is bad for business. But what in effect happens when you have a market-based approach to food system change is that those who can afford it are able to buy their way out, and the rest of the food system goes relatively uncontested. So these kind of the poorest and the most dangerous and most toxic practices continue to exist.
And regulation in agriculture and food, you know, regulation sort of goes against the grain for some. Up here, we have a kind of a longstanding rural anarchism in our lives here. But in a more general sense, what has been the history of regulation in agriculture and food? Just a word.
Oh my! Well, the most kind of well-known way that food is regulated or agriculture is regulated is through the Farm Subsidy Program, where the federal government, this began in the New Deal when the federal government started paying farmers effectively not to grow. There was all sorts of mechanisms, but the basic idea was there was the constant problem of overproduction in food, and so the federal government was trying to encourage farmers to produce less to keep their prices up. So the farmers, the government would buy crops from farmers and hold them in storage. There was incentives to reduce acreage, et cetera. All that led to intensification. So that means that farmers would just try to grow more on the land they had, and of course, you know, the land-grant universities, at the same time the federal government was encouraging farmers not to grow, the land-grant universities were spreading all these technologies that, in fact, did increase yields and encourage overproduction. So there was always contradictory purposes. So, you know, the subsidy program has had some really bad effects. Farmers who receive subsidies are often the wealthiest farmers, and the crops that are subsidized are these so-called strategic commodities like corn and soy, cotton, those that are competitive. And so the federal government's wanted to increase our exports but decrease imports from elsewhere. And so that, you know, these subsidies have encouraged monocropping and all sorts of things. So, there's no question that government involvement in farming has gotten a bad name because of the subsidy programs. But, you know, agriculture is also regulated, for instance, through the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is supposed to be watching out for the chemicals we use in agriculture. And since its inception in 1970, just a handful of chemicals have been disallowed. DDT is one of them. When we continue to have extremely toxic chemicals used in agriculture.
And what about health and safety and food?
Well, right. And so the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, regulates the health, the safety of food. And it's been a mixed bag. I mean, the FDA was began because there was a lot of food adulteration, but a lot of their regulations actually put small players out of business and gave a lot of power to the major food corporations. It's been a mixed bag. One of the things the FDA does right now is provide those food labels. So on any piece of packaged food you have a label that has calorie content, nutrient content, sodium, et cetera. That's through the FDA, and that came through a labeling act. So, you know, here's another way in which it's a kind of a neoliberal approach, because it doesn't say you actually can't use these ingredients that are bad for your health. It says you, the consumer, can make the choice through what you read on the label. Efforts to put on labels that things are, no producer that is trying to sell something is going to say, I have an undesirable ingredient in my processed food. But efforts to have voluntary labels that say, you know, my food is produced naturally or without GMOs or in all these other sorts of ways have been heavily contested, and the FDA has generally not allowed them to be put on there unless, you know, because they say, well, you can't make those claims without scientific proof. So the FDA is not really improved. It's not really encouraged sustainable and socially just practices, but, you know, sometimes it keeps some pretty nasty stuff out of the food system. So I would never want to say it doesn't do anything. You know, if there's, you know, sometimes it's too little too late, but they do recall food that's been, you know, contaminated by bacteria that's poisonous. So, you know, we have to take that seriously.
This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm hosting the new series Talking About California. Today's guest is Professor Julie Guthman. She's an associate professor of community studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and she's going to talk with us about California agriculture and California food politics. Julie, you, if I remember right, came into this subject early on in life, the subject of food issues and food politics. Is that right?
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that yourself and that development.
Yeah, you never know where you're going to end up. But my father was quite a health food nut when I grew up. He had followed all the major food gurus, Paul Bragg and Jack LaLanne. And I used to say there was never a dietary restriction he didn't like. So we grew up eating, drinking raw milk. We never went to fast food restaurants. We had to eat, like, you know, whole wheat, honey, carob chip cookies, which at the time were just horrible to taste. When I was growing up, my father thought meat was really good for us, so we ate a lot of meat growing up. Later, he became a vegetarian. But he was very, you know, he was always jumping down people's throats for what they ate and what, if they were big, his partner was kind of a big person. He was always harassing about that. So I grew up with this kind of culture of dietary restriction that just made me want to go out and eat all the junk food I could. When I was a kid, I couldn't wait to go to my friends' houses and eat the Wonder Bread and the you know, lunch meats and all that nasty stuff. So I felt that his, you know, his restrictions just kind of produced desire for me to eat crummy stuff. And later on, I changed all that. But I thought, you know, that kind of figures in my arguments about what food advice does. Sometimes I think it makes people just want what they're not supposed to have. So that played in quite a bit in my thinking. And then what was another kind of piece that brought me to study California agriculture was kind of another kind of circuitous route. I had been I had graduated from UC Santa Cruz in 1979 as a sociology major. At the time, the department was really quite radical. And when I came out, I didn't know what I was going to do, but I got involved in all these kind of organizing campaigns. We worked. The first thing I got involved with was this initiative to put on the ballot to tax the big oil companies and put that into public transportation. Imagine that today. But the people that were organizing this had worked with the United Farm Workers and the boycott houses, and so they. So I learned a lot of organizing stuff from them. And so this was in the early 80s, and, you know, just at the time when the new right was kind of rising, and I think I was probably too naive to see what was going on. But we had big ideas because we had these really good tactics about, you know, we were able to get a lot of people to sign initiatives or to sign, you know, to put bumper stickers on their cars or to register to vote. So we were working in the Central Valley. And a couple of other places, we worked in the North Coast as well, with this kind of jobs not bombs platform, where we targeted a few Congress people who had poor records on military spending, and who were voting for. You know, this was a time, you know, the wars in Central America going on, and there was, you know, Reagan had his plans for new nuclear weapons developments. So we tried to get rid of some Congress people who were on the wrong side of that. One of our biggest successes actually was in the North Coast in Sonoma, Mendocino County, and now I forget the name of the guy we defeated.
No.
But anyways, that work, you know, I spent a lot of time I worked mainly in the Central Valley. I was in Visalia County, and I was there for quite a bit. Working with people, and it was really interesting coming back to do my dissertation research on organics. Maybe, 20 years or so later, I don't know if it was that long. I'd have to think about that for a second and do the math. But quite a while later come back and see these same agricultural communities through new eyes, but finding, you know, seeing similar, you know, similar questions.
So I wanted to turn to the topic of organics. And let me ask you if we could start with this. It's an important movement, and the food movement, but it's particularly important, it seems, here in California and even here in Northern California. Could you just comment on that, the importance of, in both directions, of California in this movement and this movement in California?
Right. So, I mean, the organic movement... it would be too strong to say it started in California, but it certainly had a lot of strong roots in California. California Certified Organic Farmers was one of the first certifying agencies in the United States, along with Oregon Tilth. A lot of the original organic standards were developed by California Certified Organic Farmers. The Center for Agroecology and Sustainable Food Systems, which had a different name at the beginning, but it's that's based at Santa Cruz, and it also began quite early on in the late 60s or early 70s, develop, you know, training farmers through their apprenticeship program, and many organic farmers today were trained at UC Santa Cruz through the apprenticeship program. So there was these kind of strong institutional roots, and you know, the sustainable agriculture programs up in Davis too also spread a lot of knowledge about how to grow sustainably and organically. So there's a bunch of institutions that helped, you know, the help make the organic food movement strong through passing on knowledge, et cetera. But California has also shaped the organic food movement. And when we first, you know, when organic foods first became really big, you know, it was, we thought about them as fresh fruits and vegetables, right? Because that's what the kind of crops we grew. It took a very long time until they started having standards, for instance, for livestock. And it took a very long time before you saw much certified organic grains. And so, you know, California's center is a specialty crop. California's, you know, strengthening specialty crops also kind of affected what kind of crops were being grown organically, and again, much of the standards were developed around crop agriculture and not around livestock and or fisheries, et cetera. So there's that, and then the stuff I was discussing earlier, that so much of the way California had already was a lot of the way that farming was already organized, the kind of labor systems we had, the kind of the land values that I spoke of earlier, the marketing systems were in many ways passed on into organics. Sure, there were some organic growers who, you know, who began farming anew. Maybe they had gone to the apprenticeship program at UC Santa Cruz or had otherwise been inspired to grow organically, and maybe they bought some marginal farm, some marginal land somewhere, or some interstitial farms, and started farming anew, and very much employed a host of agroecological practices. But much of the growth in organics came in the 80s and 90s, and involved more conventional growers converting to organics. And with that, they brought along many of their production practices. And what mainly changed is they used allowable organic inputs instead of the chemicals they used to use. But the labor relations, the marketing arrangements, remain pretty much the same.
You use the term the paradox of organic farming.
Yeah, there's a lot of paradoxes of organic farming, but one of them, of course, has been that it's been a critique of industrial agriculture, and yet continues to rely on industrial processes. And again, it really turns on this land value question. When I was doing my research on organics in the late 1990s, I became very curious about the land question because, you know, what I saw was a lot of conventional growers who were moving into organics because they needed higher value for their crops. I mean, they were growing a commodity crop that they just couldn't get high enough prices, or they had lost a lot of land because their cousins and their brothers and sisters, the land was all divided up among their brothers and sisters and cousins, so they needed to get more money per acre. So they were moving into organics to find a higher value crop. But that it also occurred to me, because this has been the pattern in California, that when you grow a higher value crop, that the value of that land then becomes higher, because, you know, land values are always related to what the revenue you're going to get from that crop. So that I saw that organics was playing into this problem of land values. So that was one of the paradoxes of course, the agrarian imaginary I was talking about, that the organic growers were invoking the family farmer, calling themselves family farmers. And, you know, there's, you know, virtually every organic farmer in California employs migrant wage labor. Many also use farm labor contractors, particularly the larger conventional growers that moved into organics. So there wasn't really a change in the labor system at all.
And food politics, that seems to, you know, maybe flow from there. But food politics in California, again, we seem to be an important place in this movement. I noticed you said once, "I've nothing against good food. I eat it myself."
Yep.
and yet, I think generously, we might say that you're a bit critical of some aspects of the movement. And yet you're sort of right in the center of it in the Bay Area. I've heard you talk about Alice Waters of Chez Panisse and of Michael Pollan, the famous Berkeley professor. Could you tell us a little bit about the origins of food politics, especially with the idea of the place of California in all of that in mind?
Sure. Again, I think organics was like the first major experiment with alternative ways of growing food. And the organic movement, we have to start with thinking about the organic food movement. Because the organic farmers, they came to organic farming for all sorts of reasons. But they certainly wanted to differentiate what they were growing from what everybody else was growing. And I think one of its origins is people were frustrated with the failure of regulation for some of the worst sorts of practices. Certainly the use, that not enough pesticides were being regulated away. But most organic farmers, really saw themselves as outside of that system, at least the early ones, and just thought they had a better way of growing things. But they wanted to be rewarded for it, and so that's why, they needed the certification system to demonstrate that what they were growing was different than what everybody else was growing. And so organic food was designed to cost more. Again, it's an incentive-based system of regulation. So that seemed to be a problem. All those who had signed out on organics thinking this was the way that we were really going to change the food system were frustrated that organics didn't, for instance, ensure that farmers would be small. Some people were really concerned that, organics scaled up. Some people were really concerned that it didn't address the labor issues. Some people were really concerned about the price issues of organics. So I was among several other scholars that, started generating these critiques. My first book, The Paradox Agrarian Dreams, is this kind of major critique, a friendly critique about the political economy of organics in relationship to labor and prices and the land value problem. And so what I've seen is that a lot of the movements that have evolved since have tried to address some of those issues. And so you have, for instance, the community food security movement, which says, well, we need to support farmers and consumers, so if we can bring them together in closely knit relationships and cut out the middleman, then we'll have, it'll work out, it'll be a win-win solution. The producers will get more and the consumers will have to pay less. That hasn't worked as well as we might. In most of the initiatives developed around food security, farmers' incomes have gotten priority, and it's taken very willing consumers who are willing to pay the difference. And of course, the other comment I always have about that is we forget that cutting out the middlemen, that the middlemen, whoever that, this more than this middle guy, it's like these are often firms that employ lots and lots of workers. Just as an aside, we had a conference at UC Santa Cruz a couple weeks ago called Labor Across the Food System, and we had activists and scholars talking about food processing, farm labor, food distribution, food service, and we're talking about well over 40 million people are employed in the food industry in the United States. So cutting out the middleman is not a jobs bill, let's just put it that way. So that's an aside. Anyway, so many of the iterations of a food movement have been to address organic farming shortcomings, but most of them have focused on consumption and not production, and they've tended to believe that the market will work. And that's, from my perspective, the market is just not sufficient. And of course, one of the things that happens is the big players come and, kind of co-opt these ideas. And so, for instance, the food justice movement that has emerged fairly recently to address the problem of cost and to go further than community food security, has focused on food deserts, for example, and said, there's certain urban environments that the lack access to nutritious and healthy food. And so what happens now is, like, the Walmarts of the world are now getting permission to locate in so-called food deserts. But for me, one of the issues, like the food access problem I just discussed, is that we're focusing on access, but we're not focusing on income. The food workers continue to be paid very poorly. We're not talking about why certain urban environments have seen such deep disinvestment to make them unattractive to business. A lot of the focus now has become just like this idea of bringing good food to others. And so you see a lot of nonprofit work in urban environments where people, you know, we're just like handing out or delivering vegetables for free or setting up farmers markets. My critique of those is that they've tended to reflect the desires of people who are doing the work than those in those communities. Like in some of those communities, people say, we really just do want a Safeway. We really just do want a conventional grocery store. The larger point is that all these initiatives have generated, have been a step forward, but they've also generated new critiques, and I find that to be a healthy process. But my largest concern with the food movement is its tendency to think very small in scale, to focus on consumption, not production, and to really neglect the role of policy. I don't think the food system can be changed just by having many kind of mutual aid, farmer and consumer institutions like CSAs or farmers markets. I just think that we have to address policy. We have to address tax policy. We have to address immigration policy. We have to regulate what's allowed in our food much stronger. I think these things need to be done in relationship to these alternatives, but the alternatives themselves don't cut it for me.
Just for listeners to clarify something that people may not have thought so much about, the focus on consumption, concretely, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about that like a lot of the food justice work is getting folks, is like improving access to healthy, nutritious food, but we're not focusing on why how that bad food is being produced and try to regulate that to minimize the bad food being produced. We're talking about reaching low-income consumers through these programs, but we're not addressing the problem of low-income workers in the food system.
And you've also worried a bit about elitism in this movement to get everything out here.
Yeah.
And
whiteness.
Okay, could you just say elitism?
Elitism, because of the kind of funny story of organics, one of the things that made organics take off in the 80s was because you mentioned Alice Waters earlier, when folks like Alice Waters started selling to high-end chefs. And so, you'd see on these restaurant menus at fancy restaurants, the name of the grower, and that became one of the associations of organic food. So there's been these cultural associations with organic food, and that certainly affected people's perspectives of it. Some of the research in communities where there's these various food justice projects are being developed, it says community members just think that organic food is weird. They think it has weird connotations. They don't relate to it. There's a lot of activists that are very aware of this and are really trying to change the connotations. So one of the things that's generated is this focus on real food as opposed to organic food, like real food, just like wholesome and whole, as a way to kind of get through, to not connote the elitism that associated with organics. And the whiteness, some of the idioms that circulate in these movements draw on imaginaries that are not universal. Like, there's a lot of the gardening and farming projects, and, you know, the people say everybody needs to get their hands in the soil. It feels so good. And for a lot of people, putting their hands in the soil evokes memories that were not romantic memories, that were torturous, that were, you know, memories of slavery. And so there's a lot of the discourses and practices of the food movements are being driven by fairly privileged people who seem to feel like they need to spread the gospel and educate people to a different way of eating. And I just think that there's got to be other ways to approach food system change.
This is KZYX. My name's Cal Winslow. I'm hosting a new series talking about California. Today's guest, we're talking with Professor Julie Guthman. She's a professor of community studies at the University of California in Santa Cruz. Well, Julie, let's shift, not entirely, but make a bit of a jump here and talk about your new book, Weighing In. And this is the work I think you've been doing most recently. It's a topic which concerns the issue of obesity and how we understand obesity today and what kind of a problem, if it is, what kind of a problem it is. Could you maybe tell us about your book and begin a discussion of the things you're concerned with?
Sure. Well, I should say that I came to working on that book through my work on alternative food movements, because what I began to see about 8 or 9 years ago is that a lot of the new initiatives, like, for instance, farm programs, were being developed in the name of fighting obesity, fighting childhood obesity, et cetera. And so it seemed to me that it was like it was a solution that had found a problem. And so that's the starting point of this book on obesity, is that there's been a lot of what I call problem closure around it, that everybody's jumped on the bandwagon of feeling that there is an obesity epidemic, that it's growing tremendously, that it's inexorable, that it's a health problem that's been made out to be, and that we think we understand the causes, which are about, you know, cheap industrial food being grown, and we think we understand the consequences, which is that we will have health problems, and we know what we should do about it, which is educate people to the qualities of local organic food, and they'll all be thin. The book basically, chapter by chapter, takes apart many of the assumptions that go into all of that problem statement, and doesn't say that I know exactly that it's wrong, but we're not thinking about things in other terms. There's a lot of science out there that we're not paying attention to. There's a lot of other possible explanations we're not paying attention to. And this rush to judgment on obesity has had horrific consequences, not only for scolding fat people, but for really not paying attention to what exactly is wrong with the food system.
It can be a problem to be overweight, physically and psychologically. Isn't that true?
Well, it's certainly a psychological problem when you're told on a daily basis that you're undesirable and that you need fixing. The evidence on the health is complex. First of all, let me just say that let me start with the obesity epidemic. There's no question that people have gotten bigger over the past 30 years. I would sound ridiculous if I said otherwise. But there's a lot that goes into those statistics on obesity epidemic that really need more scrutiny. You know, for instance, the way we measure obesity is through the body mass index, which is basically a weight to height ratio. There's all sorts of things that contribute to weight that's not always body fat. It could be bone mass. It could be muscle mass. And so so it's a very imprecise way of measuring obesity. It's used because it can be obtained epidemiologically. But the main thing with the body mass index is that it's just an index. It just says, you know, you have a higher one than somebody else. And so when you want to say there's an obesity epidemic, you have to think about how you're classifying those BMIs. And so right now, 20 to 25 BMI is considered the normal range. Up to 30 is considered overweight. Over 30 is considered obese. Over 40 is considered morbidly obese. But if you look at those statistics, let's think about a move from one index point to another. So, for instance, if you move from a 25 to a 26 body mass index, let's say you're a woman of about 5'5", that's about, 6-7 pounds. So when we say that there's been an epidemic of obesity because obesity rates have just jumped, what we're really talking about is a big group of people that moved from like a 29 to a 30 body mass index over a certain period of time. So on average, it can be not that big of a weight gain that shifts a lot more people into the obesity category. Now, if you look at the statistics starting around 1980 and what they are now, there's been about three indexes. I mean, the average BMI in the 70s was about 1980, and now it's about it was about 25. Now it's about 28 or so. So that's about 20 pounds overall on average. So the question is, what's not in the averages? Well, we've seen an increase in morbidly obese people. I'm talking about very, very big people, 300 to 400 pounds. But if that means they're pulling the average up. That means everybody else's weight hasn't changed that much. And so that needs scrutiny, because if there's a lot more people that are getting very, very big, there might be something really medically wrong. But that it's unlikely to come from, you know, too much eating and not enough exercise. And the smaller averages on everybody else, it may not mean so much. So what if people have gained 10 or 15 pounds? I mean, people have grown taller, too, and there's a lot less hoopla about that. So that's not just like on the statistics themselves. I mean, there's a whole chapter that goes through these statistics. But it's also the health questions are not as straightforward as they seem to be. I do spend quite a long time looking at some of the, and in the book I talk quite a bit about some of the studies that have tried to demonstrate poor health outcomes. And, you know, they're not so clear-cut. I mean, the best studies are coming from a scientist at the Center for Disease Control, and she and her colleagues have controlled for time of death, cause of death, and they found that people in the overweight category actually live longer than those in the normal category. And so there's that, and then there's a question, you know, the link you hear between diabetes and obesity. Well, we don't know if the assumption is obesity causes diabetes, but it seems that diabetes can also cause obesity, and it's quite possible that some other thing is causing both of them. And so the direction of causation isn't as clear as everyone thinks it is. So is obesity bad for health? It's more complicated than we're being told. And it's certainly not good for mental health to have this constant drumbeat when not much seems to be done.
I wonder if I could come in here.
Sure.
I've been working with a new healthcare workers union called the National Union of Healthcare Workers.
Yeah.
They've just been presented with a new challenge from Kaiser Permanente, the huge HMO with its headquarters here in Oakland. Kaiser wants to introduce what they call a wellness program. I don't know if you've heard about this, or maybe you have, and I wonder how widespread this kind of program is, or this thinking is. They want to tie workers' health care coverage, their premiums, to their, quote, wellness.
Oh.
And it seems as if the bottom line is that, it could be you smoke, you pay more, but it's also you weigh too much.
Yeah,
you pay more. And if this is a health issue as much as a sort of cultural or individual issue in the way that you're saying, this would seem to me to be a disastrous approach.
No, it's a disastrous way to think about it, since, you know, it's like, let's give insurance to those who are already healthy. I mean, it kind of belies the whole point of health insurance, doesn't it?
Some people have, you know, try the wellness programs are, you know, all assume that people actually can control their weight, that their body size is completely amenable to our own behaviors. And, you know, many chronic dieters will tell you otherwise. It's just not clear that that's always the case. And to punish people for not falling into those categories seems horrendous. But this is where I should bring in another really important issue that I came up in the book, which is that the probable role of environmental chemicals, environmental toxins and obesity, that just is barely being talked about right now, and it really throws into question many of what we assume to be the causes of obesity in terms of our eating and exercise habits. There's some phenomenal research being done right now that suggests that in utero exposures to various agricultural chemicals are affecting obesity in adults, and this is being passed on over generations. So back to this question of wellness, to kind of punish people who are possibly bigger because of these exposures of their mothers or their mother's mothers, it's horrendous. Of course, there's when we talk about gestational exposures, there's still a possibility we can now blame the mothers. They need to be more careful about what they eat or what they're exposed to. But, you know, what it should lead to is we need to really think seriously about what we're allowing in our environment. Anyway, so there is this incredible research. A lot of it's done on animal studies. So, for instance, it shows that some of the studies have shown that mice expose at gestation to various synthetic estrogens like bisphenol A, which is in our water, plastic water bottles and Lines cans. The offspring at birth will be the same. They're fed the same diet. Their offspring at birth will be the same, and in adulthood, the animals exposed will be 35% bigger. And some lab research shows that the mechanisms for this include that the environmental chemicals induce stem cells that could have been muscle cells or bone tissues to be adipose tissue, and to proliferate adipose tissue. So once you have fat tissue, you're more likely to have it throughout your lifetime. So this this research says that that these things can be passed on intergenerationally through this process called epigenetics, where it's like turning genes on and off, so the next generation has the same sort of proclivities. So this isn't in the discussion at all, and yet here we are with the possibility that much of what goes on in agriculture is affecting our body sizes, and we have a food movement that's focused on getting people to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables and not focused on getting rid of these chemicals that have been, you know, toxic in so many ways. And here it is causing obesity. I find this to be hugely ironic in terms of food politics.
Just one last thing. Yeah. Another thing I remember hearing you saying is that you felt in the university, critical thinking was vital. And so in terms of how you expect want your students to approach food politics in the next minute, could you just say something about teaching and critical thinking?
Oh, I love teaching and critical thinking. My students come very bought into, these kind of contemporary ideas about what we should do to change the food system. And after a couple of years with me, they're pretty transformed. I mean, we still argue, they tend to be more anarchist or not libertarian, they tend to be more anarchist. And I guess I'm still believe in something called the state, just because I don't think, like I said earlier, I don't think we can change this without dealing with policy. But it's a conversation, and they become more reflective activists. And, you know, this cohort of students I'm working with right now have been very moved by the Occupy movement. And the Occupy movement has, of course,
is, whatever we might think of the Occupy movement tactically, it is changing the conversation about inequality and about what's politically possible. So this is just really exciting for me, and I always encourage my students, you don't have to ape what I think, but I really want you to be more critical activists when you go out there. And they are, and it's just really, really exciting to work with that kind of student. And again, I'm sad that our program is being curtailed because this is the kind of work we've been doing.
Oh, I wish we hadn't ended on that note. Sorry. Because it's been a very interesting talk. Wonderful. Thanks very much, Julie, and thank you to the listeners. And I'm sorry we have to stop now. And talk to you next week.
And thank you again so much for including me on your show.
Bye-bye.